In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred and Little Steven's Underground Garage, and it's time, dear listener, for another Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Joining me is Mike Campbell, famed guitarist who is best known for his work with Tom Petty and Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, but he's recently issued the debut album from his long-running side project, The Dirty Knobs. It's called Reckless Abandon, and that title track was a recent Coolest Song in the World. Let's hear a bit of it now, and then I'll return with Mike Campbell for your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
I found you in the roadside ditch, 20 bottles gone. Had your finger on the switch, all circuits were blown. Fever up to 105.
This is the Mighty Manfred, and I am so honored today to be speaking with Mike Campbell, best known for his work alongside Tom Petty and Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. He's also worked with and collaborated with a who's list of music greats, and his band The Dirty Knobs have this week's coolest song in the world, Reckless Abandon. Hey, Mike, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. I was wondering, man, where did you spend the last year holed up at?
It's been crazy. I'm pretty isolated, being really careful, and haven't been able to get together with my band or anything really. But we're hoping things will open up in the next several months. But I'm just trying to survive like everybody else.
Your family and friends been doing okay over the course of the past year?
Yeah. We've been fortunate. Nobody's gotten sick. I mean, I have friends of friends that have gotten sick.
Yeah.
But they've all come through okay. So I'm counting my blessings over here.
Oh, great. Through many of the years of the Heartbreakers, you also were involved with all sorts of other projects, collaborating, producing, playing on people's records. But you always had the Heartbreakers going on as well. So when Tom passed away back in 2017, was that just like the carpet getting pulled out from underneath you?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. It was a shock and very disorienting. And I feel like I'm in a different twilight zone now, but yeah. The world goes on, you know, but that was horrible.
Well, I spoke with him, Tom Petty, back in 2016, and he was talking about how he had been, I think, auditioning your roommate, Randall Marsh, to be a drummer for Mudcrutch. And then you were like in the next room. And can you remind me how that story worked out?
Yeah, well, I was living in Gainesville. I had a house, rented a house with a few friends, Randall Marsh being one of them, out on the edge of town, kind of a farmhouse. And I saw a poster at the university bulletin board there that this band Mudcrutch was looking for a drummer. And I had seen them play around Gainesville. They were kind of a Burrito Brothers type band.
Okay.
And so I told my drummer, our band that we had split up. We were like a blues kind of jam band. And I told him, there's a band that's looking for a drummer. It's pretty good. You should try him out. So he brought him out to the house to try him out. And they had just lost their other guitar player. So he said, oh, well, there's a guitar player in the back. I can get him if you want. So I came out, you know, in my cutoff jeans and short hair and a Japanese guitar. And they looked at me and I'm like, oh, no. Oh, God. Here we go. And so we played one song and we became fast friends.
And you were about 20 when you joined?
Yeah, something like that, 20, 21.
How long had you been playing guitar by then?
Since I was 16 or so. I'm that generation. I saw the Beatles and the Stones and stuff, and I went out, and as soon as I could get a pawn shop guitar, I started teaching myself.
Oh, okay. Now, I read the first song that you had played was taught yourself on guitar was Baby Let Me Follow You Down, that you had learned.
Yeah.
Bob Dylan's first album.
Right. A friend of mine showed it to me when I was learning guitar. And that's one of the first songs I ever played, that and Johnny Be Good. And some stuff like that. It was a great time to be a guitar player because there were so many great original bands and cool guitars and songs and stuff. I miss those days musically, really.
Another story I had read was that your mom had bought you a first guitar, like a pawn
shop.
That's
true. I wanted a, my parents are divorced, so we were kind of in financial straits at the time, and I wanted a guitar so bad. And one Christmas, she went to the pawn shop and got me a Harmony acoustic guitar. And the strings were like 2 inches off the neck. I didn't know any better, so I was trying to learn on that thing, which I did, but it would make my fingers bleed. And then a friend of mine invited me over, and he had a Gibson SG, and he handed it to me, and I just went, oh my God, this is so easy. So that was my first guitar, was a $15 pawn shop guitar.
So having to torture your hands on that $15 pawn shop guitar, did that work out okay for you in the end? Because then when you had a real guitar, it was so much easier to play.
It did. Yeah. It really forced me to get strength in my hands. And then once I got a good guitar, it was like, smooth sailing.
So there you are, you start playing guitar around 16, and you describe, music going on in the 60s, and
see
Beatles and the Stones there on TV. And so at what moment did you decide to put your mortal soul in jeopardy with rock and roll?
Well, pretty instantly, once I got the guitar, everything else in my life became unimportant. I went to college on a fluke, really. I was going to go to junior college in Jacksonville, but I was told by my counselor, you really need to give yourself a chance in life. Go to the University of Florida. I'll get you a loan, whatever. That's where I met Tom in Gainesville. Mm-hmm. And, but I was already pretty much committed that, I was going to play the guitar no matter what. But when Tom and I got together, it's like, we just like clicked, we both had the same dream and interests, and we liked the same kind of music, and we just hit it off. And we were gone, off and running.
Did your mom ever regret getting you that guitar, or was she?
No, she was so proud when we did well. She would call up the station and request songs by her son,
Oh, man, that is cool. Was it around, I'm trying to figure this out, maybe 2007, 2008, that the Dirty Knobs got together originally?
Yeah, something like that. Just some guys I met. I didn't audition them. It was between tours. Mm-hmm. I wanted something to do, and we started recording for fun, and then we liked it. So we started playing little bars around LA. And so they've actually been together quite a while, and we play really well together.
Well, so many years you're working with Tom, and you also work with all sorts of other artists. So like the Dirty Knobs, that's your own music vision.
Yeah, that's my band. Yeah. I get to lead and pick the songs and so-called sing the songs. And write the songs. We play, they follow me really well, and we get along. There's no egos, no money grabbing bastards in the band.
There shouldn't be by this point, those guys have got to be weeded out by now.
You'd think so. Yeah,
you think so. Well, tell me about the other guys in the band. They're all music vets, right?
Well, Matt Logg, everybody in the Knobs has a nickname. His name is Swamp Fox because he's from South Carolina. And then on the bass is Lance Morrison. We call him Crawdaddy. And the other guitar player, Jason Sine. So we just kind of ended up in the studio one day, and somebody turned a knob and it went. And somebody said, this is a Dirty Knob. And they said, okay, well, that's who we are. We're the Dirty Knobs.
Oh, very cool. Well, you mentioned, did you say Swamp Fox and Crawdaddy?
Oh, yeah. Jason Sine, his name is Ape.
He just gets one word. Well, what's yours? What's your nickname?
I'm Gator.
All right. I got a Gator. Well, see the Dirty Knobs getting described as being raw and dirty sounding. Now, I have to be honest, to me, that is just a definition of good sounding. But how much of this raw and dirtiness is a reaction to having to deal with what other people want. You know, if you're collaborating, working with others, they definitely have got an idea of what the sound is. Is any of this in the Dirty Knobs a sound that you have there, a reaction to some of the stuff you're having to deal with when you're working with others or not?
No, it's no reaction to anything. It's just the way we play together. Like I said, we had started playing bars to try out new songs and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it just created its own sound. And so when we made the record, I made a conscious effort to just record us all playing live together, like we sound at a gig.
Yeah.
There's very few overdubs. It's just the energy of the band, you know, playing off of each other, which I really love.
So back in 2013, you guys released a single called, was it Feeling High, back with Feed the Snake. Neither of the songs happened to be on the new album, Reckless Abandon. What was the story with that single?
It was a charity through my friend who runs Duesenberg Guitars. Mm-hmm. And he had a connection with a cancer charity. And he asked me if I would help. So we had a live recording of the song called Feed the Snake. And then I had a studio recording of a song called Feeling High, which I like a lot, but it wasn't right for the record.
Yeah.
It may resurface at some point. But that was one-off vinyl-only charity, cancer charity experience.
And then you didn't have anything until the new album, the debut album came out. Was that just because you guys were busy with other projects in the interim?
Well, that's a good question. I felt a little awkward putting any material out while I was in the Heartbreakers. I felt that was a bit of a conflict of interest with me and my partner, who I love. And we, you know, I didn't want to do anything to damage that writing relationship and friendship. So I kind of just kept them as a side project, and I didn't want to put any records out and compete with myself.
Yeah.
So I was just waiting. I thought maybe at some point the Heartbreakers would take a hiatus and then I would be able to do the Dirty Knobs. And things worked out, unfortunately, the way they did. But, you know, here we are.
Well, the album Reckless Abandon came out this past November. When and where did you record it?
We recorded at my home studio, which is a pretty state-of-the-art studio. I've done a lot of Heartbreakers stuff here over the years. Mm-hmm. And we recorded it here. It was all ready to go. We had a little tour with a few big gigs opening for Chris Stapleton and our own smaller tour that was sold out. The record was ready to go. And, of course, then the shit hit the fan.
All right.
So we've been waiting and waiting like everybody else. And we just decided that let's go ahead and put the record out without a tour because we just can't wait any longer. So we put it out, I think, in November or something.
Yeah, November.
And, you know, it's done okay. You know, and I'm really proud of the record. I've gotten good reviews on it. And it's under the circumstances, it's doing really well. So our plan is we keep pushing that same tour back and back and back. Right now it's set for next summer. And hopefully that'll happen. And by then we'll probably, or actually maybe the end of next year, it may be realistically, we'll have a second album done by then. So we'll go out and promote both albums.
Well, you worked with producer George Draculius on this one. And I know he worked early on with Rick Rubin. He's like signed to Black Crowes, worked with the Jayhawks and Primal Scream. Mm. I know that Rick Rubin produced several Heartbreakers albums before George did. When did you become aware of George and start working with him?
Well, George was always around with Rick. It was always Rick and George.
Okay.
And they'd show up together and they'd sit at the studio and bob their heads in sync, you know, and... And George is just a great vibe. You know, he really knows how to put everybody in a good mood. He's funny, but he's really smart. And there was an album called The Last DJ that Rick was going to do, but he got busy. And so we had George do it with us. And I just really clicked with George. We get along really well. And he was extremely helpful in helping me pick the songs and pick the takes on this album. And yeah, he's just a great guy to work with.
So why was he your go-to man for the Dirty Knobs album?
Well, I didn't put much thought into it. His name popped up into my head and I thought, God, that'd be fun if he'll do it, because I knew he'd make it fun, you know. And so he was up for it and he's on the team now.
Good. Well, the title track to Reckless Abandon is our coolest song in the world this week.
Yay!
Yes. My notes say that you wrote it with George. Is that right?
I did not write that song with George. There's only one song that I gave George writing credit because he came up with the title for a song called Don't Knock the Boogie.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
But Reckless Abandon is, I wrote all the other songs on the record.
Okay. And so any one person, the inspiration for Reckless Abandon?
Well, I don't think so. It was just, you know, a fantasy, a third person experience. It's funny, I've been told, and I didn't think about this at the time, that a lot of my songs on the record, including that one, tend to be about women that need to be rescued. And actually, in retrospect, you know, it could be about Tom subconsciously. Yeah. You know, people are just, you know, someone's running off the rails and needs help to keep their shit together. It's one of those kind of songs.
Well, a lot of the tracks, at least to me, have a great sense of humor to them, like Sugar and Pistol Pack and Mama, Don't Knock the Boogie.
Humor's important. Yeah.
Fuck That Guy. And I find that so refreshing. I just feel like with all the difficulties, trials, tribulations that we've got going on with us today, why, man, is there not more humor in songs, you know, contemporary?
I agree. I mean, I think humor can be overdone, but I think a little flavor of humor now and then is essential to the spirit of rock and roll. You know, I'm always able to inject, you know, a line here and there of humor. Dylan's really good at that. And I want to put forth a feeling of fun, you know? And so the songs are fun and they were fun to play and the words are funny now and then, you know, like, "Oh, honey, what'd you do with all my money?" You know, it's just instinctive trying to have fun and keep things from getting too serious.
Well, I really appreciate that.
Chuck Berry. I mean, he always had humor in his songs too.
Right. A very sly kind of winking.
Sly. Yeah.
Humor that, it's like, we're not listening to the song to get a stand-up routine, but it's just to convey a funness and rock and roll is just, ultimately is a very fun, moving, you know, your spirit's involved with the beat and you feel it, you're shaking and you're dancing. And then there's this lyric quality that when it has that humor to it, I mean, it's just more joy, you know?
I think that's true. And if the band is having a smile and really enjoying themselves, it communicates through to the listener. You know, I believe that. So that's just the way we are, you know. I guess we'd like to have a laugh now and then.
Well, over the course of the album, you got some sort of flavors from, you know, like Bob Dylan and John Lee Hooker, Link Wray, Chuck Berry. Is there some aspect of your music makeup that was not represented on the album that you're like, you know what, I should have had a song like this or that, and I'm going to definitely do that the next time around?
Well, there were a lot of songs to pick from, and George was helpful. And a lot of the songs are in different vein, you know, from the Heartbreakers years. I hate to use the word poppy, but more less bluesy songs and different approaches that maybe are in a Heartbreakers kind of feel. I tried to avoid that on this record.
Yeah.
And George was helpful in picking this, you know, a group of songs that were kind of bluesy and rock and boogie that kind of fit together. So we left a lot of other things off. As we go forward, we may try some other styles, but I don't want to get away from what the Dirty Knobs are, which is just a, you know, boogie rock band.
You mentioned, you know, if the Torg is putting back and doing a second album, how much stuff do you still have sitting in the can?
Oh, tons. I mean, I wrote a song this morning. I'm obsessed with songwriting. We have lots of songs to pick from. I have some analog music that's been collecting dust in my studio. And I've had my engineer, he's been coming in and going through these 2-inch tapes of jams and songs from the 80s, even as far back as the 80s, 90s. And he's transferring them over to Pro Tools so I can sift through them and see if there's anything worth finishing in there. So there's lots of music. I mean, it's just music around here.
Well, Mike, it sounds like you've been making the best possible use of this COVID year.
Yeah, there's been a lot of downtime is good for writing.
Yeah. You know?
It's tough, you know, being a musician and not being able to play with your band and go out and share your energy with people. I really miss that a lot, and I can't wait to get back out there. We want to go everywhere. We want to play everywhere, you know, and we will.
Well, you mentioned whenever you get this tour happening again, you'd be playing with Chris Stapleton, and on Pistol Pack and Mama, you've got him on there.
Yes.
Tell me about how you guys know each other and how did you wind up on the album?
Oh, Chris is wonderful. Actually, the only other co-write on the record is a title he suggested, which is Fuck That Guy. he took me out of my comfort zone. I had met him for 10 seconds once backstage at Wrigley Field or something. And he called me up and I didn't really know much about him. And he said, you want to try to write some songs? And I don't do that much. I usually write on my own. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. So he came out to LA for 3 days and we banged out some songs. A couple of them are on his record. And we were like, you know, birds of a feather. You know, and we immediately hit it off. And I love his voice, and I've gotten familiar with his music now. We wrote several songs. And since he was in town, I had this song, Pistol Pack and Mama. And I said, would you like to sing a harmony on it? And he was gracious enough to do it. And it was so good. I said, how about you sing the second verse? And he did a great job. And we're just really good friends now. Been a good experience.
Oh, very cool. Well, I'm going to stray off the subject here for a moment because a friend of mine is a huge fan of yours, and he volunteers at an animal rescue place called Pals and Pups. And he wanted me to ask you about an animal rescue place that your wife is involved with called Tazzy. Am I saying that right? It's Tazzy?
Yeah, T-A-Z-Z-Y, Tazzy Fund.
Tazzy Fund. Well, what's the lowdown on Tazzy?
Well, my wife used to have a dog daycare called Bow Wow Bungalow. And she developed a good friendship with her partner. And so when she moved away from the business, they stayed together, and her friend had the Tazzy Fund dog rescue. And what it's about is, you know, we do fundraising with, you know, merchandise and stuff and this and that. And the money goes to help people who have dogs that need surgery. They can't afford it. And rather than put their dog down, we help them out, you know, to get them help. And that's basically, and sometimes it, we help place dogs with homes that are, you know, left abandoned or whatever. And that's mostly my wife's thing. I'm kind of on the list, but I just kind of follow her.
Right. And if someone is interested about the organization, they can find Tazzy online.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tazzy Fund. You know, .com or .org, I don't know.
Okay. Well, we're only able to play one more track off the album as we go out here off of Reckless Abandon, and I'd like us to go out with some Sugar. It's got a very Ivan Link Ray kind of vibe to it. Do you think that's fair to say?
Yeah, that's a good analogy, yeah.
Is that a cowbell on there?
It's a big-ass cowbell, yeah. Actually, I think it's three of them at once.
Really?
Well, that was an afterthought, really. We had the da-da-da-da. There's this big gap. And I thought, what could go there? Obviously, a cowbell. It became part of the song. Now we have to set up a big cowbell live so he can hit it in that spot.
Oh, man, that's a great audience participation part right there.
There you go, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then
it's a fun song.
And you know, and whenever you bring somebody up to do it, you can always stop them and say, no, more cowbell. You know,
more cowbell. But yeah, there you go. I knew that was coming.
And that tune is one that you wrote yourself, right?
That's yes, I did.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just a guitar riff. I thought it was kind of Stonesy or I don't know, but it just, I like the groove. And you know, it's hard to come up with guitar riffs that haven't been done already. And that one, I think it was just in between a couple of other different riffs, slightly similar, but it had its own vibe. So the song was just built up from that.
Yeah. So thinking about Sugar there, she was a bit too sweet for your taste, or what happened in the end?
Well, you'll have to wait for the second album and we'll revisit Sugar and find out where she ended up.
Terrific. Well, Mike, thank you so much for talking with me today on Our Coolest Conversations.
Yeah, well, thank you. I really appreciate your involvement, and I like your compliments. Really well appreciated. So thanks for your time, too.
Certainly welcome. Right now, here's some Sugar, courtesy of the Dirty Knobs, and off of Reckless Abandon and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
She don't know her way around the kitchen.
The Dirty Knobs serving up some Sugar for us here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. That track is off their debut album, Reckless Abandon. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Mike Campbell for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Olivia Callahan for producing our podcast. Next time around, I look forward to speaking with Irish singer and songwriter Imelda May. She'll have a new album out in April, but a couple of the singles have already been released off of it, so we'll give a listen to those and we'll talk about the long player. That's your next Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stevens Underground Garage.
In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.